Maybe also using a lot of that, like in Britain, we also have a problem where you can only have a certain number of people above the anti-training laws, and we have a certain number of people.
Ah, so Jan, kannst du nochmal kurz helfen?
But they sort of, it's almost like, yeah, because I'm Canadian, and in Canada,
ich habe so Lust, hier in den Are you a Canadian?
Oh, I have this one. Yours, please, take mine. Oh. No, it's fine. I can take a few one. Okay. Hello? Okay. Welcome again to the second European conference of the Platypus Affiliated Society. Today we have the panel on Women, the Longest Revolution. I will start with reading out the description of the panel and then I will introduce the speakers. First of all, is it okay for everyone to take, if we take pictures? Anyone doesn't want that? Okay, that's great. So, Woman, the Longest Revolution. Named for Juliet Mitchell's 1966 essay, this panel will explore the long history of the struggle for women's liberation from the vantage point of the left today. Mitchell critiques bourgeois feminist demands such as the right to work and equal pay, to posit the need instead for equal work. She calls for a politics capable of taking on the fundamental transformation of society and more immediate demands, in a single critique of the whole of woman's situation. In keeping with the spirit of this essay, we ask again what the relationship might be between the struggle for social emancipation and the particular task of feminism. How have leftists imagined this relationship historically? What do we make of it today? While the woman question has played an important role in the history of the left, the knee-jerk inclusion in current leftist politics does not necessarily reflect a greater understanding of what the struggle for women's liberation might mean politically. How exactly is it the longest revolution? When did it begin? If the crisis of bourgeois society and the Industrial Revolution posed the need for women's freedom as inseparable from the project of human emancipation, then what do we make of the later separation of the feminist movement from the workers' movement for socialism? What do the seeming successes of feminism tell us when considered in relation to the failure of the proletarian struggle to deepen or realize the task of human freedom? So, to my left is Cornelia Möser. She studied cultural studies, gender studies, and sociology at the Humboldt University in Berlin. Since 2010, she's a member of the gender as an academic category.
Well, that's over.
That's over now. Good to know. And today she is an academic at the French CNRS for gender studies and history of ideas. And she's working with terms of sexuality and feminist and queer thinking in Germany, France, and the US since the 1960s in respect to subject development theories. Then I will continue with Lucy Parker. Lucy Parker is a member of Platypus and she's based in London. That's all. Sorry about that. That's a short introduction. Okay. To my right is Ursula Jensen. She's a founding member of the external tendency of the IST, of the international Bolshevik tendency in the US and in Germany. She's a long-term member of a works council within the IG Metall and a delegate of the IG Metall. And then we have Joy McGrady. She is a journalist and revolutionary social activist. She writes and edits a monthly column on women's liberation for workers' power. And she's been active for nearly two decades, and she has participated in national and international campaigns. Okay, yeah, I thought maybe you could start with your introduction.
Okay, well, thank you very much for the kind invitation. Well, as also activist Fridays for Feminist Saloon of Berlin, who organized in 2010 the event on the queer feminist critique of the economy that was called Who Cares in Berlin. I have to say that yesterday I was told that it was not 15 but 8 minutes I had. So I will now spontaneously try to condense that. We received questions for this panel in advance, and so I kind of stuck to these questions. The first question that you had asked was if struggle for women's liberation figures into the task of the project of human freedom. So my answer is yes, it does. So as even the writer that you quote, Judith Mitchell, says, feminism has what she calls a totalist quality, meaning for her that it's necessary in order to reach human freedom in general. Yet the struggle for women's liberation did not sign up as such for liberating the working class from bourgeois capitalism, but it signed up for liberating women, all women, so also working class women, from patriarchy, male domination, male chauvinism, heterosexism, gender oppression, whatever you want to call the current sex-gender system we're living in, to borrow a term from queer thinker and anthropologist Gail Rubin. I know this question very well from socialist and Marxist context, and it's almost always expressed in order to reduce feminist struggles to the place of a less important side struggle. And if you're asking what has feminism done for class, for class struggle, I suggest we also ask what has socialism and Marxism done against sexism and male dominance, and be it only in their own groups. If we understand human freedom to be the freedom of all humans, not only of white bourgeois male humans, we have to take into account a number of struggles, and feminism is one of them. So even Judith Mitchell, in the text that you're quoting to give the title for this panel, brings up the history of how radical feminism can also partly be seen as being the result of violent sexism in Marxist and socialist left. So I agree with Judith Mitchell when she underlines how there have always been feminists that saw feminism as a struggle for human emancipation. Feminists read their Marx, their Engels, their Adorno, their Foucault, but the same can unfortunately not be said of male socialist interest in feminist theory. I feel that feminist theory has remained accessory to the dominant left until today. So until this blockage politics stops, human freedom is not possible, at least not with the left being part of it. That was the first question. And in your next question, you ask, what would be necessary to emancipate the woman? Let me give back the question. What would be necessary to emancipate the man? What would be necessary to emancipate the Marxist? Women's emancipation has been successful in the last decades. And I guess the same cannot be said about men's emancipation. As humans, men, women, and nonconformist genders obviously also need general social change concerning the mode of production. But this is very much linked to feminist struggles, as the economy is always already gendered, and this needs to be taken into account. So you're asking also if revolution is needed for women's liberation. I think that it really depends on what you understand by revolution. Eva von Redeker, a researcher at Humboldt University, questions ideas about revolution that necessarily imply war-like scenes or riot scenes, and prefers to think of revolution as a radical change that can also happen through persistent politics like reforms or collective mobilizations. I think that the recent peaks in violence against women in Europe and North America, so there have been studies published recently that show that violence against women has gone up, that they show that the success of feminism has to face also counter-mobilizations, and that neither men nor capitalists will accept the redistribution plans of feminists, leftists, or leftist feminists that would take them away with their privileges, resources, or means of production. So I guess at some point, reforms necessarily confront limits, and the power question remains, pointing at the legitimacy of violence. And that is true as much for gender oppression as for capitalism. In your second question, you're asking to what extent feminism is, as such, an adaptation to the political failure of socialism. So I was not very sure to understand what you mean by adaptation. But if you mean, like, I have heard very often in Marxist circles being like, okay, feminism is kind of like the result also of changes of capitalism. It's just a way that society adapted to capitalist change. And then, if that is what you were trying to say, I'm always surprised how Marxists lose their, forget all about their Marx when it comes to feminism, because he already has told us that the history is a history of class struggles, history of struggle, and that there's no teleological or God-given prescribed forces or nature that forms history. So he insists that societies change because people struggle over power and influence, over rights and over distributions, over living conditions and modes of organization, and that also applies for feminism. So obviously, like, feminists have been part of this historical process. If by that you wanted to say that feminism profited of the failure of socialism, my answer would be absolutely not. And even, like, especially in Germany, I feel like with East German socialism, women have lost many things, among them be it just the right to abortion that we don't have anymore since the fall of socialism. Your third question brings up the often quoted failed marriages of feminism and Marxism. So it's true, like, the so-called second wave feminism, they were kind of detached from the what people call the first wave of feminism, also through the World Wars and the Nazi crimes. And when they talk about their startings, they explain it as kind of starting from scratch. So they were inspired by civil rights movement in the US very much, and in Europe often they describe their consciousness raising as being part of a general movement of the new left in the 1960s, where proto-Marxist frameworks of thought have been very popular. But quite quickly, like, they have integrated these frameworks of thought in their own theoretical production, but also experienced their limitedness, that these, like, proto-Marxist theories could not account for, they could not explain gender oppression the way that they were experiencing it. And this is why they have also been part of, they not only turned to what people call structuralist or post-structuralist theory, but I would go so far as to say that they are part of, they even formed and brought upon what people call post-structuralist theory, because this attempt was also what unites them with post-structuralist, or what is named postmodernist thought, is that I would see, like, for example, Foucault's rethinking of power also in reaction to failures of the 68 revolts, and that he wanted to, that they also experienced the same frustration with proto-Marxist explanations of how power works in a society. So this is where they join feminists' concerns, and why they also became then, like, also were produced by that, but also why there was this strong exchange. You're also asking how can feminism and Marxism be combined, and I have to ask back, how can they not be combined? I mean, like, I have the feeling there's a tendency in Marxism to forget that women are also workers, and that workers are also women, and that obviously, like, it cannot not be combined. So I'm trying to be very quickly and to get to the end. In your last question, you're asking me if the situation of women in the world has changed since the 1960s, and you're criticizing tabulations of gained equality and suggest to rather speak about gained freedom. So, of course, the situation of women around the world has changed, with and without feminism, and also in the dominant rich countries. I kind of refute your term of advanced countries, because I would like to ask in which ways you consider colonialist, imperialist countries to be more advanced than the countries they are exploiting, And would you then also say that men are more advanced than women, and if yes, on the scale of what? And so to get back to your question of the situation of women, I'm not a demographer and in any way qualified to tell you any details about the many changes in gender and sexual politics worldwide. And also in feminism, within feminism, there are ongoing debates on how to quantify or objectify freedom or even equality, a question that remains complicated way beyond feminism. So this is a general question, I guess. From personal political experience, I have to say that in most places of the world, we cannot afford to let go of politics of equality, even though we have to bear in mind their limitedness. A feminist revolution obviously is also played on a symbolic level, on a cultural or even interpersonal level, but feminist struggle has always simultaneously played on all these different levels. And I think that's a good idea. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, Ursula Jensen, could you continue?
Okay, if Marxists know very well that a worker about whom we speak, when we say working class, can very well be a black, female, gay, handicapped, single mother. So a worker, in our view, is not a man, necessarily. The means by which male supremacy is enforced vary considerably from one society to another and between social classes within each society. Every woman are taught to regard themselves as superior, and women are taught to accept this. Few women have access to power and privilege except via the connection over their man. Most women in the paid labor force are subject to the double burden of domestic and wage slavery. Frederick Engels once said, "In the proletariat, the man was a wage slave, and the woman was the slave of a slave, doubly oppressed, first as a member of the working class and then as a woman." From its inception, the Marxist movement has championed female equality and women's rights, while regarding women's oppression, like racial, national, and other forms of special oppression, as something that cannot be eradicated without overturning the capitalist social system that nurtures and sustains it. Marxists assert that women's liberation is bound up with the struggle against capitalism. In the final analysis, sexual oppression serves the material interests of the ruling class. While Marxists and feminists often find themselves on the same side in struggles for women's rights, they hold two fundamentally incompatible worldviews. Feminism is an ideology premised on the idea that the fundamental division in human society is between the sexes rather than between social classes. Feminist ideologues consequently see the struggle for female equality as separate from the fight for socialism, which many dismiss as merely an alternative form of patriarchal rule. In the past several decades, feminist writers and academics have drawn attention to the variety and extent of male supremacist practices in contemporary society. Feminists have taken the lead in exposing many of the pathological manifestations of sexism in private life, from sexual harassment to rape and domestic violence. Prior to the resurgence of the women's movement in the late 1960s, these issues received little attention from either liberal or leftist social critics. Feminists have also been active in international campaigns against female genital mutilation in Africa, female infanticide in Asia, and the imposition of the veil in the Islamic world. Feminist analysis is often useful in raising awareness of sexism in capitalist society, but it typically fails to make a connection between male supremacy and the system of class domination which underlies it. Marxists maintain that class conflict is the motor force of history, and reject the notion that there are irreconcilable differences between the interests of men and women. But we do not deny that men are the agents of women's oppression, or that men benefit from it, kind of benefit from it, both in material and psychological terms. Yet the benefits that most men derive from women's inequality are petty, hollow, and transitory, and the costs that accompany them are substantial. Undervaluation of traditionally so-called female work, while appearing to benefit the men who are better paid and have more job security, in fact exert downward pressure on wages generally. The same applies to wage discrimination against immigrants, youth, racial minority, or any other sector of the workforce. In addition to lowering wage rates, male chauvinism like racism, nationalism, homophobia, and other backward ideologies obscures the mechanisms of social control and divides those at the bottom against each other, thereby providing a bulwark for a hierarchical and intrinsically oppressive social system. The Marxist strategy of uniting all those exploited and oppressed by capitalism is sharply counterposed to the reactionary utopia of a universal sisterhood, uniting women across class lines. It is true that female oppression is a trans-class phenomenon that affects all women, not merely those who are poor or working class. The degree of oppression and its consequences, however, are qualitatively different for members of different social classes. The privilege and material benefit enjoyed by ruling class women give them a powerful interest in preserving the existing social order. The notion that women's oppression would continue to be a feature of life under socialism seemed obvious to those new left radicals who viewed the economically backward, nationally isolated, deformed worker states of Cuba, China, North Vietnam, North Korea, and Albania as functioning socialist society. While women made very important gains everywhere, capitalist rule had been overthrown. The parasitic and overwhelmingly male ruling bureaucracy in these Stalinist police states promoted women's role as breeder, mother, and homemaker. Leon Trotsky pointed out in The Revolution Betrayed that the Stalinist apparatus was an obstacle to the development of socialism, and criticized the social interest of the ruling stratum in the deepening of bourgeois law in connection with its attempt to prop up the socialist family. Feminist pessimism regarding the prospect for women and under socialism, as opposed to under Stalinism, reflects an inability to comprehend the historical origins of women's oppression. It also reveals a failure to appreciate the immense possibilities that socialism would open up through the elimination of material scarcity. The revolutionary expropriation of the productive forces and the establishment of a global planned economy would ensure that the most basic conditions for existence, food, shelter, employment, basic health care, and education, could be guaranteed for every person on the planet. How much time do I have left?
It's over now.
Sorry, I was also told that it's 15 minutes that I have. I prepared 12, so later more. Breaking up in the middle of it.
Yeah. Okay, Lucy, I think you could continue.
Hi, thanks. I'll just say briefly, this is the first time I've tried to address this question. I mean, I've never been able to find it before in the past, but someone tried to write about the women's question, and I'm not providing, as anyone who knows Plattipus should know, we don't have positions, political positions, so I'm trying to distill some lessons from reading that I have done in Plattipus, and hopefully later on in discussion we'll try and just reflect a bit more on my own personal experiences in interacting with the left. So we'll see. This might be a bit abstract, but I'll do my best. What is key for me about Juliet Mitchell's essay is not that she critiques bourgeois feminism's demands, but that she provides a critique of the history of the left through various attempts that have arisen to address the problem of women's emancipation. It's both a sympathetic critique and a ruthless one, which perhaps is what makes it a good critique, to help to try to clarify the possibilities presented as well as the limitations in any particular idea or moment of political action. The socialist idea is that women's unfreedom is an index of the unfreedom of society as a whole. Socialism is a project attempting to address concrete crises arising in society, specifically to capitalist society. The suggestion is that capitalism is a social problem, not just an economic problem. The development of modern society and of capitalism, whether or not necessarily arising out of it, has posed society and its social relations as the problem. The woman's question has only really become a question through the development of modern society and later in capitalism. Marx attempted to add specificity to the socialist project through critiquing it from within. This is still, for Mitchell, the central premise and the central possibility, but the idea is limited insofar as to the extent that it has not been articulated completely concerning the contradictory experience of women's lives in modern society, or where it has been dealt with concretely, but has taken a partial form, which has failed to reckon with various mutually constitutive and constituting crises that have been taking place in society, which all impact on women's lived experience. So Marx and Engels' understandings remain key for her in the essay in terms of addressing a woman's position within the production process, but the other constitutive elements that have produced her relatively marginal position, which they suggest through the problem of a family, are for her still not sufficiently elaborated. In one sense, these appeared as new aspects of social crisis and new concurrent demands regarding reproduction, sexuality, identity, relationships, kinship groups, and child-rearing in the 60s and 70s. Mitchell is able, therefore, to address and critique the possibilities and limitations of such demands, as they, too, only address the problem in a partial manner, failing to consider how these aspects are in turn constituted by social relations of production, which women also participate in, or are excluded from. At the same time, the respective aspects of sexuality, identity, etc., which were always there and implied in Marx and Engels' ideas, even if not articulated in the way these questions were posed in the 60s. Mitchell uses this moment where the questions are being posed, including by feminists, questions which express real social crisis occurring in society, as an opportunity, perhaps against the dominant trend, to return to Marx and Engels' thinking, which through returning to it aims to underscore what they already recognise, that the way we live our lives in capitalism and the social relations which constitute it are already in crisis, meaning that these critical questions of sexuality, identity, kinship relations all are, as the family, the individual, and humanity are, in fundamental crisis. The individual, its identity and practices, the relationship between the public and private sphere, express another aspect of society in crisis. What it really means to be human is also a question, becoming increasingly contradictory in capitalism. Marx and Engels' characterization that humanity is unique in giving itself its own species being, that it that is not predetermined, but in capitalism it appears to, that it may have freely created the conditions of its own unfreedom. So Mitchell quotes Marx at the end of the essay saying, "What is progress if not the absolute elaboration of man's creative dispositions without any preconditions other than antecedent historical evolution, which makes the totality of this evolution, i.e. evolution of all human powers as such, unmeasured by any previously established yardstick, an end in itself? What is this, if not the situation where man does not reproduce himself in any determined form, but produces his totality? but he does not seek to remain something formed by the past, but is the absolute movement of becoming. The liberation of women, she continues by saying, under socialism, will not be a rational but a human achievement. In the long passage from nature to culture, which is the definition of history and society. I would say that Mitchell writes to address the social crisis in the 60s, which expressed itself in the civil rights movement for racial equality and later echoed in the women's movement, that second wave feminism as an idea for Mitchell also expresses these real concrete problems and contradictions that were being faced in terms of women's freedom. That the politics of feminism arose due to what appeared to be new needs in society, but these might have also been old needs that were yet to be met. Whilst I think I understand and might also agree with the politics of, with the idea that expressed in the question, the politics of feminism is an adaptation to existing social conditions, insofar as it appears concerned only with the recognition and equality in, within existing civic society. Mitchell is also addressing that within the history of the left, past attempts to address women's emancipation failed through their partial character. And as socialism itself is still an unmet task, so attempts to meet it have instead contributed to reconstituting new and different unfreedoms. How much time have I got?
You've still got 3 minutes.
The Bolsheviks, within the first few years of the Russian Revolution, made considerable efforts towards women's emancipation and sexual liberation through the immediate legislation of homosexuality, the right to free divorce, and the socialization of housework and childcare. Trotsky later described in the Revolution Betrayed, as has been brought up, describes how these new attempts to transform society came up against economic limits of the new society and state that had been forged, but was still under pressure from all sides by surrounding capitalist relations and the capitalist state. A social revolution failed to spread elsewhere. The return of the ideology of the traditional family as the only means to meet the reproduction of the society expressed a continuing unmet need as capitalism in the world as a whole was still yet to be overcome. But the idea presented a new form of the old unfreedom, which no doubt also obscured rather than clarified tasks still to be met for the left. As it fell below the bourgeois right of the individual to the right to work, to a private sex life, free of the necessities of reproduction. The new left ideology, therefore, needs to be recognised as arising out of the failure of ideas and practice of the old left. Discontents within capitalism continue, therefore, to play out in different ways, sometimes experienced as a desire for greater sexual emancipation, sometimes as freedom to sustain a family life being curtailed, sometimes as the question of women in the job market or the right to abortion, sometimes as the demand for societal recognition of one's individual differing or changed identity, or for one's personal relationships to be recognised as legitimate by the state. Mitchell's essay points to the fact that where these needs and discontents remain unmet, they will continue to express themselves in new ways. Feminism of the 60s and 70s was an attempt to do this, but was also, she argues, insufficient in addressing these different mutually constitutive aspects of the problem, and instead fell into, to use some old left language, new forms of reformism on the one hand, such as demands for a greater welfare state, and voluntarism on the other, such as kind of intransigent calls for the abolition of the family. Today, old needs have yet to be met on a global scale, and some new needs have arisen. But whether the existing left is able to address these meaningfully is a real question. Marxism itself is often understood today merely as a theory of oppression. Class is reduced to an identity category to be intersected with others in a hierarchy of oppression or privilege, where once, according to Marxism, it meant something very different and expressed something of the historical problem of society to overcome itself through and beyond capitalism. How we try and understand or grasp demands made in the present on behalf of women's emancipation is still unclear, when the memory of what socialism was trying to to achieve has itself become obscured.
Thank you. So, Joy, maybe you could continue?
Okay, yes. Well, I'm part of Workers' Power, which is also the British section of the League for the Fifth International, and we do take positions. So what I wanted to do was really outline our positions, because I think that will feed into the discussion and the debate afterwards. And I think it was interesting. I thought Juliet Mitchell's essay was very interesting, because I think it really got to the crux of the debates between Marxism and feminism. And it is a very appropriate title, Women, the Longest Revolution, because men's dominance over women existed before capitalism, in the sense that it originated in the development of class society and also class antagonisms. So capitalism has entrenched the subservience of women in society, and it rests on private property, which is owning the means of production, and also the family unit, where the new class of workers reproduce themselves and their labor power for free, which of course is very important for the capitalist. And although the capitalist mode of production draws in an increasing number of women into the labor force, giving them greater economic independence, the family unit has been maintained and keeps women in domestic bondage. So, you know, we all talk about the double burden of working outside the home, but also doing the majority of the housework within the home and looking after the children. But at the same time, it also provides an opportunity for women to overthrow these chains. So we agree with Engels when he said that the emancipation of women and their equality with men are impossible and must remain so as long as women are excluded from socially productive work and restricted to housework, which is private. So the emancipation of women becomes possible only when women are enabled to take part in production on a large scale, a large social scale, and when domestic duties require their attention only to a very minor degree. So he made that statement in The Origin of the Family, Private Property and the State. So while this doesn't guarantee women's liberation in and of itself, it takes women out of the private and isolated experience and pulls her into a socialized working environment where she can begin to organize with other working women and men in trade unions, with wildcat strikes, you know, as part of the working class. And you think about that today in terms of the flight attendant strike on Lufthansa. It was great to come into Frankfurt and to see the whole way along. It's like cancelled, 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 all these flights. So that's, you know, the power of the working class. As Marxists, we understand that it's the working class that has the capacity to transform society into one in which the economy is socially owned and the output is shared equally as socialism. So as Marx and Engels said in the Communist Manifesto, society as a whole is more and more splitting up into these great, huge, you know, hostile camps, into two great classes directly facing each other, which is the bourgeoisie and the proletariat. And those that own the means of production and those that only have their ability to work and to sell their labor on the market. So this is the historic battle. And women, like men, are divided into classes. Women of the ruling class can offload a lot of their oppression that they face in society onto working class women, whether that's nannies or housekeepers, personal assistants, etc. And their privileges will always tie them to defending their class before their sex. And so the idea of the all-class women's movement, promoted by feminists, obscures the different class interests and effectively seeks solutions within the capitalist system. But the working class itself is the class with the radical change that can't be broken except by uprooting capitalism and destruction of the class society, which is indispensable for ending all forms of oppression. So these include those like racism that flows from slavery, colonialism, and imperialism, and those that flow from the oppression of women via the institution of the patriarchal family. And just as the working class is the central agency in the struggle against capitalism and the exploitation and the oppression fostered by the system, the revolutionary communist position on women's liberation takes as its starting point that working class women are the central agency in the struggle against their own oppression, aided at every step by class-conscious working class men. So in that sense, they won't be liberated, but we will liberate ourselves. And it sees in working class women among the most oppressed and exploited of their sex, those with the most potential for mass struggle. So that was Lenin's position. And, you know, there's the old saying, there can be no socialism without women's liberation, and no women's liberation without socialism. So these two things are completely inseparable. And socialist revolution not only opens up the road to all liberation, but without it, liberation is impossible. However, that does not mean that the struggle against oppression must wait until socialism exists, or that the struggle is subordinate to itself to a narrow and economic definition of the class struggle. Okay, so I'm sure many of you are thinking, okay, yeah, this is really not anything new. You know, maybe a bit Marxism 101 in terms of women's liberation. But I think it's really important because the theoretical starting point becomes crucial when you start to talk about how to organize women within the revolutionary movement. And I think Juliet Mitchell was very correct when she identifies that the second wave of feminism was a reaction to the failure of the left and other revolutionary movements in the 60s to really challenge sexism within their own ranks and to treat women fighters within the struggle as equals. And you know, you heard the stories of, you know, women are demonstrating with the men, they're getting arrested, they're getting attacked by the police, but afterwards, while the men would sit around digesting what was happening and planning the next move, the women would be cooking dinner and looking after the kids. So that is sort of low-level everyday sexism. There's all, at that time, and you know, can be today as well, there's sometimes open hostility from the men against women taking the lead or putting forward their demands. So women had to fight to be part of the struggle. And of course, this was even worse when, in the late 1800s, when Clara Zetkin of the German SPD and Alexander Kollontai of the RSDLP, and later the Bolsheviks, were organizing. You know, in many countries, women weren't allowed to join trade unions or political parties or vote. And revolutionary women were fighting for their rights, but they also fought within their political parties to create special organizations and movements of the oppressed within and outside the Revolutionary Party. I think this is really key. So they knew that these special organizations are actually necessary to draw the maximum number of them into the struggle against capitalism, against its inherent sexism, racism, homophobia, and transphobia. They also recognized the prejudices and oppressive behavior exist among workers and revolutionary communists and have to be constantly fought. So Clara Zetkin argued that women need to be organized, their rights defended. She built up a massive organization of working class women within the unions and within the SPD. There's like 140,000 within the SPD, and also produced a specific newspaper with a print run of over 100,000 aimed at women, organizing women. She also recognized that once in the movement, women had to continue to be organized to press for their interests and be taken up by party and unions as a whole and to challenge sexism. So this meant educating men and involving men who worked amongst women. And this tradition was taken up by the Bolsheviks and Russia, and later by the Communist International, led by Lenin and Trotsky. And Kollontai, along with Zetkin, helped really to push the question of women's organization onto the agenda of the Communist International. And they argued that each Communist Party should build a women's section to do work amongst women workers. They rejected the all-class women's movement of the feminists and counterposed the working-class women's movement led by revolutionary women and linked to the general struggle for socialism.
1 minute left.
All right, I'll speed up. And so anyways, so like the Bolsheviks set up their own women's section, and also, I think Lucy also touched on the fact that, after the revolution, the Bolsheviks really passed all these laws to undermine the material underpinnings of women's oppression, and they were like rolled back under Stalinism. But in the absence of a revolutionary, a mass revolutionary parties today, what we should be arguing for, but we should argue for, advocate the right of women and other oppressed groups to caucus. I think that is really key. So in trade unions, all the different working class organizations, I think it's really important that women and other oppressed groups are allowed to meet to discuss any issues relating to their oppression and the struggle against all examples of sexism or oppressive behavior, and agree to submit and should be able to submit proposals for dealing with these issues directly to the membership and the leadership of the organizations. And the other thing that we should be arguing for is really to raise the call for a working class women's movement. So this would take up the whole spectrum of women's oppression, domestic violence and rape, discrimination at work, inequalities in pay, cuts in child care and health care, and would also combat the sexist culture of capitalist society. Because really the historic crisis of capitalism that we are living through right now has impacted working class women very severely, both as workers, especially in the public sector, where they're often the majority, who have seen their jobs and wages and pensions and their whole workload increased, like the jobs and wages and pensions completely cut, and also all the cuts to services and healthcare and things like that as well. So a working class women's movement must set out to draw on women in the unions, in the housing estates, in the schools and colleges, uniting them in a common struggle, and they must have democracy and autonomy with the right to elect their own leaders. And then I just wanted to, you know, add at the very end, which is that no organization is entirely immune from the reactionary ideas and forms of behavior in the society as a whole. So working class organizations, trade union, and reformist parties, you know, they don't automatically or spontaneously oppose women's oppression, just as they do not spontaneously become socialists. It requires a conscious struggle by a revolutionary party with the right policies and program to fight against sexism, racism, and reformism.
Thank you very much. Yes.
Can you please talk closer to the microphone?
Yeah, sure.
Sorry.
Okay. Okay, so the next round will give you the chance to answer to the other speakers on the podium. You can start.
Okay. Well, there's many things to address, I guess. I will try to be very quick. So one thing that I have heard like many times now is, maybe that's even a question also to, especially the two of you, when you are criticizing feminists to put gender oppression first, like what, I felt that like, yeah, like you've used the like word, the feminists, they do this, like what feminists are you more precisely talking about? That would be a question. And this also gets to a point I wanted to make about the question of alliances, let's say, because I would rather speak about alliances between, let's say, working class or bourgeois, I mean, if these categories today even make sense, women. And I think we could use, there's one term in, for example, gender studies that is used that's called intersectionality of forms of oppression. I think that can really help to try and understand what's going on there, and that, for example, gender oppression will not go away with socialism. I mean, we've seen that in history. And I mean, you also mentioned the example of like the relative sexual freedom after the October Revolution. And so my question would be like, was it really the capitalist societies next to this experience of socialism that were responsible for the fact that these freedoms have been taken away, or wasn't it rather Stalinism who destroyed it? Or maybe I didn't get it right. But, so it's important for me also to like to see that like socialism as such will not abolish gender oppression. So I think women have profited from alliances between different women, like also alliances with bourgeois women, for example, to get the right to vote, to get access to universities. And all of this is reformism, huh? It's all reformist, but seriously, I'm kind of happy about it. So, right to abortion. Like, I think also working class women have profited from the capital, let's say, social capital, or even like sometimes also economical capital, political capital of bourgeois feminists in these struggles. And that makes sense for me. And like the last thing I would like to address is just to, because like I've been hearing a lot about, on this panel about like the women and men and the women being exploited by men, which is true, but this is only one side, like only one part of the story. It's not only like be exploited as women, it's also the oppression to be forced to be a man or a woman. that is being addressed. And I think, like, I kind of feel like Judith Mitchell is really nice, is a really nice writer, but like, there has, like, this work you're citing is like from 1971 when feminism started. Like, there has been like decades of feminist theory ever since, and what I was trying to say in my first statement is like, I kind of feel like I'm right when I say there's so much feminist theory that is not read in leftist circles, and I'm very sad about that. And I feel it's not the same the other way around.
Okay, thank you. Ursula, you can continue.
Sure. What feminists are you talking about? Cornelia asked. All the ones I know. Basically, and you might be the exception, but I don't know you that well yet. Gender oppression is not something that goes away after the revolution immediately like a bang, so now that was it. But we will not get real women's liberation without it, not in this society, and that's why that's not something that we will give up afterwards. Now, you said those are just reforms, and reforms are not bad. No, they are not. And if they are reached, we will certainly defend them. We won't let reforms be taken away from us. But that's not what we are about. We fight for something else, something more than reforms. And if you fight for reforms, and you have put a limit to your fight. We will fight for a socialist revolution. But anybody who does reforms before that actually is coming short of what is needed. But reforms are okay.
Do you want to say more?
Oh, no.
Okay.
So I guess I have a question. So I have questions for everyone. Cornelia, I would like to understand maybe a little bit more. Ursula had to make a point about class conflict being the motor force of history. And I want to understand more, and maybe this does reflect some ignorance. But what from a gender studies perspective, or from your particular studies in gender studies, how do you approach the question of history? How does gender arise in history? What would we do about that? And then I guess for Jordan, Ursula, it's interesting. I guess I would like to know more from you both about how, if, for example, we were to put together some kind of like list of transitional demands for women, what that means in the present, when. And I know this is a question that maybe you've been, Ursula, you may have been confronted with already at the conference, but in the absence of a kind of desire for socialism on a broader scale, I think, just to come back to the point about reform and revolution, that from my understanding from Rosa Luxemburg, she was kind of arguing that without the kind of idea of revolution, we cannot actually achieve reforms in the present, even if we don't even get beyond capitalism, but without this idea of fighting for something more than just the immediate reforms, we can't even achieve a reform. So I want to ask Joy and Ursula how you put forward transitional demands in the present, given the history of socialism in the 20th century and what's happened. And so, yes, and I was saying that the problem of Stalinism, I was trying to address without being Stalinophobic, but trying to like address that. Yes, Stalinism as a state form did produce like a sort of a regressive idea of like family, in my opinion, but that has to also be seen as having produced by the fact that. The revolution did not manage to kind of move further at that point. So, but that, does that just? It certainly wasn't Stalinism. Certainly wasn't socialism. So it's not clear yet. It's actually not clear yet. Just even though I'm also asking about what we do when no one wants to fight for socialism. I would argue we haven't ever had socialism yet. So we don't know that would not. Provide the conditions for greater women's emancipation. I wouldn't say that Stalin's emancipation. That was what you meant.
Okay, thank you. Joy, would you like to answer?
Yeah, well, I agree with that last point, especially that Stalinism is not socialism. But also in terms of fighting for transitional demands, like fighting for reforms is a really important part of a revolutionary socialist agenda and a really important part of the campaigns that we do.
Could you speak more into that?
I'm sorry about that. What I was saying is fighting for reforms is actually a really important part of a revolutionary socialist strategy because we want to fight for things here today. But the thing is, as Lucy pointed out, the idea is not to stop just at winning one reform or another reform, but actually to knit them together in a list of really transitional demands. And what does a transitional demand mean? It's something that you can fight for today, and it might be achievable, but in actual fact, it puts so much pressure on the capitalist system and sort of ignites like a whole, you know, it really starts to pose the question of who has the power in society. And it's those type of demands, like the transitional demands, that actually will, you know, as actually leads, instead of having a maximum and minimum program where you say, well, we fight for reforms here and today, and then we want socialism. But this is a way in actually to take the step forward to actually make it there. And I think these are really important. And like, you know, everything, like, we can unite with bourgeois feminists, radical feminists, feminists of all different perspectives on certain issues, but the thing is, as revolutionary socialists, we want to, like I say, take it to the next step, right? So, like, let's say the fight for abortion rights that's happening right now, you know, there's a big campaign happening in Ireland, which is huge and stuff, and we would definitely participate in that because that is fundamental, you know, for women, for their struggle. But the problem, I guess, with just having the idea that we'll win one reform or another reform, the thing is that the capitalists can always roll that back. I think that's what we need to think about and why I tried to lay out what our positions were, is because what you have to see fundamentally is that these two struggles would go hand in hand, the class struggle with the women's liberation struggle, and it's these how they come together, and neither, you know, it's not one is, you know, subordinate to the other or anything like that, but they go hand in hand because the ultimate goal is for liberation of all. So I don't know how much time I have, but...
1 minute.
Oh, okay, so I'll keep going. So anyways, and I wanted to come back in terms of intersectionality because, again, I tried to outline sort of the basis of our position within my introduction, which is the idea is that, to me, I don't think as socialists, we should use the theory of sectionality. I think as revolutionary socialists, we should really be champion, you know, any struggle of the oppressed. That's true. But the thing is that when you use the theory of intersectionality, it's sort of like it focuses on the oppression and not on the agency for change, which is the working class and the struggle, the working class struggle and things and the socialist struggle. And I think that's, you know, to me, that is the crux of the argument. And it's not just about tick the box who is most oppressed, but it's about the agency towards social change.
Okay, thank you very much. So we will open for questions. I think you were first. And then Laurie, and then Richard.
Wait.
Yeah, he needs a microphone.
I would like to make a remark regarding one.
Put it closer to your mouth.
One point regarding the contribution of overlap. You said the difference between Marxism and feminism is that feminism substituted the contradiction between men and women. Put it in the place where what is the contradiction between the classes for Marxism. And I would say that it is true for one tendency in feminism, for a special version of radical feminism. But what is more characteristic for feminism, from my point of view, is that feminism sees its own limits, while Marxism sees not its own limits. Marxism claims to be a theory of the society in its rule, but in reality, Marxism is only a theory which analyzes the relation between the classes. On the other hand, feminism sees it and analyzes mostly the relation between genders, but claims not that it's also an explanation about class relations. And I guess this difference regarding seeing the own limits is the more characteristic difference between the two theories. And for this, when we start from this point, I think it's not enough to say it's important that women become part of the labor unions and that they're part of the revolutionary organizations, but it's necessary to see that we need different kinds of political organization, that the solution for or the overthrowing of patriarchy is not the socialist revolution, it's not a socialist organization, but what we need is revolutionary feminism.
Thank you.
I wanted to first make a point and then ask a question. Since the fantastic victories of the 1970s for feminism and the reforms for women's rights that were achieved, Roe versus Wade, the right to abortion, the right to access to proper health care, birth control, the right to have state-funded abortions, these kind of reforms have been receiving a backlash quite more aggressively experienced in the United States, but I'm sure that with the continuation of the steering direction of the European Union, that we will see the cutting back of welfare benefits for women, relationship to taking care of children, etc., by the state. And so, you know, we have the pressure of these drawbacks, particularly in the US. I think that it's the very much pushed by Hillary Clinton point that the support of single mothers, funding of single mothers to raise the children has been one of the major slashes of funding that Clinton supported. It just has to be said, sorry. The interesting thing for me is that even though we have to defend and push against those backlashes, I also want to open up the opportunity of what are more radical differences. A friend of mine in this room once gave me the Sheila Miss Firestone book that I read, absorbed, because it proposed the idea that in this futuristic society, women wouldn't have to carry a child themselves. The society, the somehow a fantastical machine.
Good
but
thing.
Even though I don't know how I feel about that proposal, I was fascinated by the imagination that it proposed. And my question to you is to open up this question of the imagination, what are some radical demands that we want for women? Is equality all that we want?
I think like one issue of like where sort of feminism often has sort of conflicted, or certain streams of feminism have sometimes conflicted with other tendencies on the left is in the very complicated question of not so much economic demands for equality or reproductive rights or things like that, but the question of sexual liberation in general and what that means in its fullness. And I was thinking about sort of, you know, the scandal in the Socialist Workers Party in the UK and them being raped apologists. Or I was thinking about like what a campaign and an issue that's very big on American college campuses now, the whole discussion about rape culture, yes means yes, or the pornography wars of the 1980s. And I'm just sort of curious how all of you see these issues and how they've played out.
Okay, who wants to start? Joy, you want to start?
Yeah, I was just sort of trying to gather my thoughts. Obviously, to me, equality under capitalism is not what I want, in the sense of like that's not the only thing I want. I don't think equality under this system will ever really come into play, because capitalism uses the divisions, whether it's sexism or racism or homophobia, uses the divisions to undermine working class solidarity, but also undermine, you know, wages and all sorts of other things. And so even when there's gains on one level and things, there's always the reactionary bit on the other. And we point to a lot of things like in the US right now in terms of the threat on abortion. Sorry. Oh, sorry about that. You know, the threat that is playing out in terms of the access to abortion, which I think is really, is really horrific for women in the U.S. And I also think about, I don't know if you've heard about the Hobby Lobby legislation or ruling that came through, which more or less gave the rights of this boss the rights over the contraception that he would provide for his workers, the women workers and things, and, you know, to get out of Obamacare and things, and it was ruled that that was his right. And so who, you know, his right as an employer trumped the rights of his women workers. And, you know, for me, you know, the most important things is that these are some of the issues that the trade unions should be fighting for and things. And that's why, again, I come back to why I think it's so important that these two struggles are in, the two struggles are intertwined, but also the fact it's really important to have within, you know, trade unions, within political parties, within revolutionary parties, all these, they have these structures where women are organizing themselves and fighting for their rights within the organization. Because unless women raise our voices, if we wait, you know, unless we raise our voices and we organize together and we fight against the sexism that pervades society, then we're always just going to be doing these sort of two-bit, you know, things. And I think that's the way of transforming what we, you know, when we talk about transforming society, that's the way we're going to do it.
Okay. Lucy, you can go ahead.
I guess your point was sort of that Marxism is the two become kind of opposed in this antinomy of like Marxism being a theory of class struggle versus feminism becoming a theory of gender relations. I suppose I was trying to address the way that these two aspects are kind of, for Marx and Engels, part of the same problem of mutually constitutive of problems in society as a whole. I feel like it's a problem in the present left that these appear to be sort of broken down, so that it becomes this question of class versus gender, gender versus race, race versus class. I wonder if something's happened to Marxism for that to appear to be the case today. I guess
on radical imagination, it's funny, I don't know if anyone has seen or remembers this movie from the 90s, Junior, with Arnold Schwarzenegger, where she like raises, where he raises the child. I mean, it's like, it's horrible in terms of like representations of kind of traditional gender, but in terms of reproduction, yeah, why not demand that men could actually have the right to bear a child? Yes, it could be done by machines too, but why not? I don't know, there's all sorts of things that might be possible. the SWP, I would like to hear what the other Trotskyists have to say about this too, because I also think it was a real crisis for the SWP, but it became understood in kinds of very peculiar ways. It became understood as somehow also related to the problem of democratic centralism, when I think actually like many anarchist movements, other sorts of leftist organizations have also had problems of sexual exploitation taking place. I don't really have a solution to it at all. I think I would also note that the failure of the SWP to kind of address that question has probably ruined Marxism for many young women. However, there are many young women also still fighting within the SWP, and I'm not prepared to call them rape apologists. For continuing to kind of think that their organisation has some value in raising issues about socialism. So, but again, I still, there's this problem of where the left is at, and that these marginal these kinds of crises seem to tear these small organisations apart when, and really it's kind of strange because they have such little impact on society as a whole. So, yeah.
Wie du willst.
Okay,
so you go first.
I'm still stuck with what you just said, that the groups are torn apart by, because like that really sounds like this old like feminists dividing the working class. That's not where you wanted to go, were you?
No, I think it's also a problem of it's a problem of leftism in this period of kind of the left's death or decline, that these groups are so small that these controversies kind of, when they do occur, and they're real controversies, I don't want to deny that's the case, but they mean the organisation is unable to find a way to work through it, and it just creates kind of disintegration.
Because I kind of feel like that's important to, like, not, I, for me it's important to really state that, like, the problem in that kind of cases is, and also the problem maybe why these groups are so small and unimportant and so unattractive for everybody who's like from, like why, like I always remember like when you're like, oh, we're only men on the panel, let's find a woman, they're so hard to find. And it's the same like with questions of social relations of race. I think like unless there's not like some serious consideration of sexism going on in these groups, like people should stop to wonder why. To get back to your question earlier, how is history being discussed in gender studies? It's obviously like a large thing. So obviously there has been like at least since the 60s and the 70s a huge
research field being opened up by feminist historians who like first wanted to go back into like, because history has always, up to that point, also by just the mere exclusion of women from university altogether, been written by men, and they only wrote about men in history, so like it has been a long and very complicated enterprise to write history, like also with regards to history of women, to find even traces, because like there have not been so many traces. That has been like an ongoing research work that is going on until today, but that has more recently started to, like when first they were asking for the history of women, nowadays they are trying to understand also that like there's not one history of women, and they're trying to understand women also as an intersectional category. So there's like different history, if you're writing the history about women in slavery, if you're writing in colonialism, if you're writing history of bourgeois women, if you're writing, so like they're trying to understand this in an intersectional framework, which I would still try to hold up, because if you've been saying that intersectionality would only speak about oppression and would not sufficiently address agency, I don't agree with this. And I think that you've been saying that the agency of the working class is not sufficiently being taken into account. Kimberly Crenshaw, in her article that is often quoted as, well, I mean, like there has been intersectional thinking about relations of oppression and exploitation in feminism before. I just want to quote the Kimberly River Collective, for example, and that there's an entire tradition that has always, I mean, Angela Davis, right? We've been trying to think that together. But like the important part of Kimberly Crenshaw for me is that she's actually talking about a car factory, about General Motors, if I remember it correctly, and how there have only been black women being fired, and so they couldn't like say that General Motors was being sexist because there have been white women still working there. They couldn't trial them for being racist, because the black men have still been working there. And so she was trying to find a way to explain how these women, as black women, have been discriminated against in General Motors. And in order to, so I think there can be also agency as women, there can be agency as black women, there can be agency. I think there's not like one agency in society, so that is. There have been other things. I'm actually working on questions of sexual revolution and on sex wars. In my recent research project, but I feel I already talked a lot, so maybe later on.
Okay, you can go next.
Yeah, I'm not sure how many women are here that have given birth, but I certainly won't have that right taken away from me, because it was a great experience, and I wish it to a lot of you. But that just as an aside. Feminism has a bad name in Germany. The role within the Third Reich was certainly something bad. So if you want to be in an organization that is not a feminist organization, but is one that works for women rights, I might even join you. That would be okay. But just like I don't call the Soviet Union a worker state, which we did in 1917. We had to find a new name. We called it a deformed, degenerated worker state. That's the same thing that I wouldn't call myself a feminist, and I wouldn't be caught dead calling myself a feminist. Now, if you understand that feminism is something that one shouldn't call oneself in this country, certainly, then we might find another name, but I think we have more differences than that. Feminism has gone over full-blown to fascist organizations, has called, I mean, they were all für Küche, Kirche, Kinder, and that is certainly, I presume that everybody knows that, those. I don't have to translate that yet.
Sorry, can you translate that, because I didn't understand. Church and
kitchen.
Children.
Yeah.
Children. It was one of the fascist slogans. And the feminist organizations dissolved themselves. into a fascist organization here in Germany. So fascism, feminism, is not something that you would call yourself if you have a little bit of an idea about history in this country.
Jewish feminists, don't they exist for you? I mean, like Bertha Pappenheim, they have not, I mean, they have been kicked out by other, that's not one feminist.
But, okay, the, a few women have gone out of the feminist organization, but the rest of the feminist organization went full-blown over to the fascists. So that is why feminism in this country has a bad name, for me.
Feminism in Germany came certainly just before the 60s. The first leg of the women's movement in Germany
it's not true.
Feminist,
no. I think we should talk about that historically with a bit more material at hand.
Women's rights activists, they didn't use the term feminist. Sure.
Good. So noticing that you call yourself a feminist and I wouldn't call myself that. We can find out what are the reasons for that. But I think that our differences go much beyond that. And that's why I think it would be better to talk about that. I think that workers' power and the IBT agree on feminism to almost 95%. A little bit is there still a question on what exactly you mean with a women's movement. We should find out about that at some point. But assuming that we are now talking about a women's organization, then the question would be, what kind of women's organization is that? Is that a women's organization that is cross-class lines? Would I have to be with Hillary Clinton, who I do not consider a dime worth of difference between Clinton and Obama? Shall I be in the future with her in one organization? I don't know good examples for a lot of the other countries. Angela Merkel, yeah. No, I wouldn't want to be with her in one organization. I fear that she won't apply, and I don't think she will apply to be in the IBT, but that makes me feel good, actually.
That actually leads me to the question that I was thinking about. We were talking here about reformism and how you think that reformism in feminism is a way to achieve goals. Well, I think in the like parts of the old socialist program for women emancipation have been achieved without a revolution and without socialism. Like if we talk about abortion, obviously since the 1960s things have improved. And so it seems that a lot of people, that progress for women has made for them, I think many things have been achieved in the bourgeois society. So what does this say about the favorite issue of the Marxist left today, the resistance to neoliberalism? Like, so what is your opinion about, on the one side, the connection between reformism and revolution, and on the other side, what do you say that neoliberalism helped to achieve goals, feminist goals? And now we have a few more questions. I think you put your finger up first, and then you, and Jan. I know, but we only take three at once, but you can go as well if you want to.
I appreciate it, Cornelius. Reference that what about the oppression to be born male or female? That wasn't commonly the law in the panel, but I would like to ask Cornelia what she thinks about the quotes that Lucy mentioned about Marx saying that the humanity provides its own species being.
Provides what?
Its own species being, that its nature is that it has no nature, it's already formulated by Marx, or that the other quote, that humanity is not predetermined by any yardstick. I don't remember the exact quotation. So you said that a lot have happened that you people haven't followed, but I sense that there were things, and this is true, that Marxists forget that aspect, perhaps, that you mentioned, but also the feminists have forgotten that this freedom to not be born in something predetermined also was mentioned by Marx and Marxism. And I would like also to ask all the panelists their opinion about precise demands. Some feminist movements or women liberation movements had specific demands about, for example, polygamy against monogamy, not nuclear family, only extended types of family. And Juliet Mitchell criticized all these specific demands as rape fight, as forms of anti-freedom, as static forms, whereas the point is to keep the plurality, or again, the points to freedom and not a right of specific identity to exist in a given reality. I don't know if that's...
Yeah. He's next.
Okay, thank you. I think it's certainly the case that the emergence of the feminist movement or movements is, if you want, so a response to a narrow position on the question of women and social liberation by a large part, I wouldn't say all of the left, and there was a lot of discussions about the historicities of various revolutionary movements and so forth. But generally speaking, yes, it was, I think, without any doubt, a response to a real problem the left was facing. Just, and I think that's not unique to the question of women oppression, we can also see a similar phenomenon with the environmental movement, I think. And I'm sure there are many other movements as well. This is not the, but I think the important thing which points to me, in my opinion, is not what I think, but on the theoretical level. I think there is a distinction between feminism and Marxism in the point that I think Marxism, at the end of the day, is a theory, so to say, which deals with the totality of the production, reproduction of material life. And that, of course, implies for it to have a theory, a theoretical understanding also of how women's oppression, just as any other form of oppression, is actually connected and tied in different class societies in a different way to the kind of class oppression in this society. And I think the class struggle remains the driving motor, so to say, of development. But I think that isn't there a problem, and that's the question, so to say, when actually the left has, in the absence, I think, of the revolutionary left, was significant proportions for a long period, so I think there is more room. Actually itself adopted a very narrow notion of liberation and of socialism. If you want to say, if you think about social democracy and Stalinism, so liberation is that you have it material life where you can survive somehow relatively okay. The welfare state in the West, and a similar form of relation for the workers in the East, yeah, with the reproduction of the bourgeois family and all that. And of course that, I think, is something we have to break from if we really want to engage in a different vision, if we actually seriously discuss about the question of liberation after and in the struggle for socialism.
Hi, I would like to say a little bit to Ursula. First off, I find it really, really weird as an argument that you would actually say that most feminists went over to support fascism, because at least in Austria, where I'm from, a lot of women who fought for their rights were communist and Jewish, and they had to flee the country. So obviously there was no women's movement afterwards anymore because they were all gone. But they could certainly not go into fascism. And secondly, you said that Marxism always fought for women's rights. And I have a couple of examples of sexism and its symptoms that occur in leftist and socialist and Marxist groups. And the first one is male domination groups and organizations. May it be dominant speech or hierarchies. And then you've got the pseudo-feminist men who try to explain to women how feminism works and how they are supposed to behave if they are truly feminists. And you've got groups where men who dominate the group decide that every piece that is published by that group is not going to be in a gender-neutral language. And this also concerns inter-trans persons, because most of the time they decide that maybe they're going to make it gender-neutral for women, but not for other people. And the self-representation as a feminist group also entails that the groups where there are not a lot of women, the workload for women is much higher, because wherever the group goes, or whatever events the group hosts or whatever, they say that women should be present from that group. And also, a lot of men just don't deal with feminism. They call themselves feminists, they call themselves communists. They say that they want the emancipation and freedom of, and equality for everyone, but they just don't deal with feminism. And also, a lot of leftist groups that include men don't accept women's spaces. And a lot of the time I've noticed that women in leftist groups end up doing all the reproductive work. So, yeah. I wouldn't necessarily say that Marxism always fought for women's rights.
Thank you.
Can you please hand it to Jan?
I'll just have two quick questions. The first would be, we're dealing with a debate in mainstream media and throughout society with gender quotes in higher offices and stuff like this. Would you consider something like this as progress? For example, the election of Angela Merkel as progress? Just a quick question. And the second would be, we have here at least two people from the New Left, or from the time from the New Left, and not necessarily anymore, but the organization. So throughout the 70s, there were lots of splits due to sexism, and here in Frankfurt, there was a split of the SDS caused by Trolls of Tomatoes and stuff like this. Would you consider, would you consider these kind of splits as legitimate, or, that would be question.
Okay, I'll just sum up the questions to remind you. So we had the question about reformism and Marxism and how far reformism can work out. Then the goals of neoliberalism, the question of polygamy and the family, the remark on whether Marxism can be sexist, and here the question for gender quotes and yeah. Okay, maybe you start again.
Me?
Yes.
Okay, I'm
much time I have just to know if I choose questions or if I answer?
I think 3 to 4 minutes.
Okay, I choose questions. Yeah, maybe only two things. One thing is like, it's actually rather a question. Why do we need one total theory formula to magically explain everything? The second remark is on neoliberalism, because this is a very, very popular critique also, not only against feminism in the Marxist left, but also against queer theory recently. And of course, as this also gets to your question earlier when you said, what do I understand in like how societies change in history, and it joins also the aspect of the new left, because I think like, of course, neoliberalism is also the product of the new left in the sense of like deregulation of work and like something like teamwork or that kind of like values, corporate identities and stuff. I think this is also the product of the new left, and I think it's not all bad in the sense of like people have been fed up at that moment. Like this, the uprising of the 68 movement was also an uprising against very conservative hierarchical structures, and it was important for people to like to change these. Even like if we see that they did not abolish capitalism with that, but it also and we also see like all the bad outcomes of that. But also we can understand their intentions, and I think like I'm always a little surprised, like, or maybe it's just like being bad losers or something. Like if like people get jealous of this of the success of feminism, because like socialism hasn't been as successful, and like trying to understand like in which ways, like maybe it's true that like more fluid gender, like then people always say like more fluid gender models would like would fit perfectly well into neoliberalism, and like I'm then like okay, but like rigid gender roles fit better to socialism, or like I don't get really the argument, and I can only see like most of the time it's really just about homophobia. I can't make any other sense of that.
Okay, Ursula, would you like to
continue? Yeah, left groups certainly can be sexist, but what is sexism? Sexism is thinking that women are less intelligent, less whatever, in regards to men. I've never been in an organization, except for the trade union, that has had those positions. And even the trade unions don't have those positions, but you certainly meet a whole bunch of men who consider women as genetically stupid. Most of them won't say that anymore, but because they know that they immediately will be called out for it, but that certainly is still a prevailing position. But in the left, the groups I have been in, I would quit from an organization that would have such a sexist position. But I certainly have heard about other groups. But I mean, just because some are doesn't mean all are, and I'm sure you know that in general, or I hope you know it. Polygamy and the family, the IBT doesn't particularly care what people do in the bedrooms, or if you want to say in the fields when the weather is good. We don't really care about that, as long as everybody involved is so in their own free will. So the more the merrier, fine. All good. There is a big difference between reformism and Marxism. Reformism is the enemy of Marxism. We don't, but we, if the reformists make a win a reform, it's fine with us. But that's not what we stand for. If reforms fall off the tree, when we really want it, not the leaf, but the tree, is a different thing. Then we will also take the leaf. And we will even defend it if somebody wants to take it away from us. But reformism is an obstacle to the revolution. And that obstacle needs to be politically fought against.
You said something different before.
I did?
Yes.
There's a difference between reforms and reformism.
Okay. Yes, yes.
Okay.
And I hope I made that... I certainly wanted to make that clear, yes.
Okay, I was just wondering... Yeah, maybe I'll use the microphone. I was just wondering because just before you said that reforms can be very important, so...
Okay.
So how would you define reformism?
Yeah. Okay, an organization, a political sense that has as its goal reforms and not wanting to go beyond a reform. So let's say a good reform is abortion rights, but that's not where it should stand. It should be much more. Somebody actually asked, I forgot to address the thing with quotes. Quotes is always a bit of a problem. I recognize that putting quotes on certain elections has helped women to get more jobs and certain more hierarchically higher jobs in certain places. But I always think that if it wouldn't have been Lenin's turn, but the turn of a woman in 1917, I would find that very sad occurrence.
Okay. Lucy, you can continue.
Joy,
do you want to go first? Oh, you
want to go first? I didn't indicate, but I could go first.
Okay.
Yeah? I guess just on that last point about quotas, like, I do think, you know, having more women bosses actually won't make much of a difference for women workers, right? So all these, because what they're talking about is quotas on boards of companies. I don't think that's going to actually make any difference whatsoever.
You say that much better than I did, but that is what I meant.
Okay. and just... But I did want to come back on what happened within the SWP, and because Workers' Power in Britain had a position on that, and we wrote a number of articles. And I'm so sorry, I'm really just terrible at this. But anyways, so about the SWP and what happened, and Workers' Power in Britain actually wrote a number of articles arguing our position about that. And if you really think about it, like, it was a terrible situation that also was compounded by sort of the undemocratic nature of the SWP itself. But that didn't have to do with its democratic centralism or its idea of democratic centralism. But the idea is also that it was also its sort of the economism and the tailism of the SWP politics, I think, was also was really the root of the problem. And what do I mean by that? It's because the SWP has never acknowledged the material benefits that men derive from sexism within society, and so they've always argued that it's sort of just an ideology that comes down from the capitalists, or the capitalists, you know, promulgate this, and then it's just somehow taken up within the working class, and that's not the case, actually. There is a material benefit, and that doesn't mean that men conspire with the capitalists to oppress women, but they do have a material benefit, and I think that, you know, that came sort of to me the crux of the issue, but also the way the SWP actually handled it. And because they have this idea that, you know, the men that don't benefit, they also have the idea that women don't need to have these, like, special structures within the organization, like caucuses. So they refuse to allow women to caucus, and to actually have this had this discussion out. So instead, it went actually through the structures of the organization, which were very undemocratic. But I think what we were arguing is really that the women within the SWP should caucus together and actually should, have it out. And at that conference where they actually discussed it, they right afterwards, after the vote was taken, which was very narrowly in favor of that there was no case to be found, then they shut down all discussion about it completely. And I think that's what again led to the splits and everything. So I think we need to think about that. Like, I just think, it's very important that different groups of oppress within organizations should have the right to caucus. Because as I said before, sexism, racism, homophobia doesn't stop at the gates of the organization. It pervades into it and things. And having these structures means that it's not as if it's going to completely eradicate all sexist behavior, but it will give the people that are affected by it, give them agency to actually change the culture within the organization and change it. And I think that's why, coming back to you, your question was around the idea of, like I said, a working class women's movement. That's what we'd be arguing for, and that would cut across all the trade unions, the different political left organizations, but actually come up to have a movement that would really bring to the fore, issues around women's liberation, and especially at this time in terms of the crisis in capitalism, like women are really being hit hard, but I think our voices are not being heard loud enough, and I think we need to work together, and that's what I mean about agency to change. And I wanted to say one more thing, but do I have time?
Okay.
I wanted to talk about, I wanted to just to give a small I wanted to tell a small story about during the miners' strike in the UK, which was huge. It was from 1984 to 1985, in case you didn't know, but it was massive. It was a Thatcher's attack, massive attack on the working class. And in the mining villages, it was a very gendered society in that sense. The men went down the mines and the women stayed at home, looked after the kids and everything. And when Thatcher launched her attack on the miners, all of a sudden that whole structure and the social norms that existed actually began to change, because women became active in the struggle to fight for their families, their way of life, everything. And so no longer were they just like organizing soup kitchens, but they were going around the country, they were giving the speeches, they were organizing demonstrations, they were challenging the government. And that's what I mean about agency, about women coming together to fight. And one of the women that were involved in Women Against Pitch Closes, at the end, obviously the miners went down to defeat, but at the end, they managed to completely change how their world worked in that sense. And she said, "I was so proud, we may have lost, but I was so proud to stand up as a working class woman defending the right, defending the livelihoods of working class women in our community."
Okay, thank you. Lucy?
I mean, I think we could take
We could take some more questions.
Okay.
So, Rashid, you want to go first, and then... Who hasn't... Oh, you didn't put up your hand before that. Okay, sorry. So who wants to talk as well? So you... Ah, okay.
Some break to the next one.
I thought that was
the
sort of
summing
up.
You
mentioned something like a critique that didn't address the new conception of gender and gender relations from the perspective of neoliberalism. I'm not that acquainted with this kind of critique, so I want to insist a little bit on this. I would like to set something like a framework. In Marxism, we consider, let's say, that the task of modernity, or I speak as a Marxist, we consider the task of modernity to be something like the advancement of the consciousness of freedom, and not of freedom per se, but the consciousness of freedom and what does exactly that cause to the course of history. I wanted to ask if, let's say, after neoliberalism or during the neoliberalism era, there is a certain understanding of freedom that gives rise to this formulation of gender relations. Because, according to my opinion, or according to, let's say, standard opinion, all these kind of descriptions came to that era. And so I would like you to comment on this specificity, this historical specificity. And at the same time, I would like you to comment a little bit on this diversity that has been formulated or has been created during during the neoliberal era, that has, without question, caused an inability of the different fractions of the antagonistic movement to raise the task of emancipation, of, let's say, of the general emancipation of society. And in order to be more concrete, do you consider the, this kind of advancement as only a progress in the task of human emancipation, or at the same time, this this way of addressing freedom has a regressive aspect?
I had two questions, actually. Firstly, one to Lucy, and I just wanted to invite you to answer the question that you posed to Cornelia before, and to make you think about what you might want to say on the topic of history yourself. I guess I was thinking then about something a little bit along the lines of what Yorgos just said about the consciousness of freedom, and something that was said on the panel earlier about capitalism being at once a period in which exploitation is intensified, but at the same time, a period in which desire for emancipatory social change is also intensified, and whether there's a connection that we can draw here with the emergence of women's struggles. The other question I wanted to ask was, I guess, going back to the story about the miners' strike, and whether there are, whether those on the panel are familiar with other kinds of struggles which have developed tactics, where women have developed tactics. For instance, I'm thinking of the movements in the 70s, wages for housework and the social strike, these kinds of ideas, and whether you think these kinds of things might be interesting to us at the present time.
Okay.
I was going to add a small question to Cornelia about, because she said that, that feminism is successful while socialism is not, and my question would be, what's the success of feminism?
Okay, I will take all the last questions, and then we'll do the final round. So, Richard, Stefan, and it's you. Anyone else who wants to ask anything? Yeah, I know. I already pointed out to him.
First of all, just one brief comment and then a question. The quick comment, I found the gap, the leap from sort of economism and the SWP to weight, I find that a little hard to make. Like, it seems to me that, like, questions of sexual violence are, like, operating in some different realm from questions of material privilege that has to do more with psychology. But that's a separate. I guess my main question is, if I go outside of this room and I talk to sort of normal people, and I'm thinking particularly about the United States, of course,
normal people?
Yeah, people who are not, like, haven't read, Marx, but normal people that I've interacted with in daily life. They, terms like racism, sexism, and homophobia mean a lot to people. Like, they can relate to all of those three terms. And, however, thinking about class struggle, that's extremely alien to people. And that wouldn't necessarily have been the case, in the past. And I guess there's a way in which sometimes I feel that language of specific oppression has rendered like class struggle or Marxism becomes like a foreign language that is no longer understandable to people. So, you know, there's a lot of talk about Obama's the first black president or Hillary Clinton or, you know, gay rights, but the questions of broader economic organization. So even when you speak about like how you separate feminism and Marxism, it seems to me in the mainstream of society, that's exactly what's done all the time. Right? I'm not saying you're trying to separate those, and I just sort of wonder how you see that development, right? That in some ways you're saying, well, Marxists don't pay attention to these specificities, you know, but then in the general society, those specificities are what people see as the struggle of the left.
I want to come back to something Cornelia said, and to be honest, I'm a little disappointed that it wasn't picked up again on the panel. And the first thing was the question why the speakers were confronted with the text, which is from 1971, and the question why hasn't there been any more very significant Marxist feminist theory, so to speak.
There has been. It has just
from the Marxist side, as you said, because you were complaining that Marxists were developing any further on this
topic. Only that the male Marxists don't read it. There has been a big, big production of leftist, socialist Marxists, like materialist, theory.
Then I got you wrong, sorry for that. But also that you were referring to the problem that there couldn't be one formula or one theory to solve everything at once. But I guess Marxism wasn't meant or intended to be a theory of totality, but to be a critique of totality, to be a critique of the fact that in capitalism, things get to be treated as a totality only. And so my question is, can there be this force to see things as a totality, and because society forces people to see it as a totality, for example, the question of women. I mean, there's a big difference between struggle for women's emancipation in Central Africa and in Germany. It's a big struggle because, as you were pointing out, in Germany there's the question of how does it have to be that you're treated as a man or as a woman from the beginning only from your life on, while in other countries it's very important that people who are recognized, identified as women, need to gain certain rights to care for their basic material health and wealth. And so my question is, can it be that there's totality and difference at the same time? Can it be that the emancipation of women is not possible under the conditions of capitalism, and still that the transformation of capitalism to what was called socialism by Marxism would not be possible without taking the women's question, as it was coined, seriously, and pushing this to its own limits, and even understanding the contradiction that traditional Marxism obviously had, which were brought up by Juliet Mitchell in the essay, and still seem to be unanswered by Marxism until today.
Okay, one more question over there. Please hand it over.
Just a comment and later a question, a big question. The comment is about Marxism, and I think that is maybe dangerous to try to understand feminism or women struggles like a kind of secondary oppression and try to integrate in Marxist theory exclusively. I understand from my point of view that feminists, or at least the feminists that I know, try to rethink about the theoretical critique of society and rewrite and try to visualize the critique of society and the different Marxism. Then I think that is quite dangerous to understand from this point of view. And another question to Cornelia, and I think that is your name, right? And in general to the panel, maybe you have been talking about that because I have been late, but if you can tell something about the queer theory and how you understand this conception about power in terms of no liberation of woman, but in terms of understanding this productive power, this deconstruction of categories and blah blah blah. If you understand that this is a useful theory to articulate the struggles in the woman terrain and in the lesbian LGBT terrain in woman LGBT. Thank you.
Okay.
Alex.
I have a very simple question. Well, ultimately, what would you say is the end goal of feminism? Like what is feminism fighting for?
Okay.
Another hour.
I'll give it to you to answer these. yeah, maybe Lucy, you can start.
Roll your eyes more intensely. What is history? I don't know, maybe in the present, but I guess I've been influenced by Marx's ideas that and as we were talking about, I find it quite a compelling idea that somehow the class struggle is a motor of history, but also I'm still trying to understand what that means, and especially what that means in neoliberalism, which also appears to have this character of being post-historical or no longer concerned with trying to understand history. There's a sense in which history for Marx kind of arose as a question in capitalism, so it's also historically specific. I think, as I was trying to point out at the beginning, I also feel like the questions of questions of freedom and women's freedom have been posed in a particular way in modern society that they have not been done so in previous traditional forms of society. So. I think it is a peculiar problem to modernism, and I don't know what's happened now. I also wanted to say something before about. I guess also there's this question about progress, what it would mean for us to progress today. But more concretely, I wanted to also say something about. Quotas and things within leftist organisations. I really don't know when. I have a lot of ambivalence of even talking on a panel discussion like this because I am a woman, and I guess I would like to be in a situation where we could have had a man on the panel as well. And whilst I think. There's a kind of it's strange. I think there's like a problem with there's something that Juliet Mitchell points to it in terms of like socialization and maybe gender theory picks up on this too. But in terms of like how people behave in society as kind of learned behavior. Which I don't think any leftist organisations are kind of exempt from. I think it is a problem. But I also don't know. I don't think women are exempt from sexism either, or people of colour are necessarily exempt from saying racist things. I also have trouble with this idea of quotas, sometimes because I feel like it. I'm not sure if I'm being selected as a part of a quota, what I'm representing. I had a concrete example. This was within briefly being involved in Left Unity in the UK, and so I was very rapidly elected to represent a branch from only going for like two meetings, and I kind of felt like, what, like I'm not. How am I possibly qualified to represent the interests of everyone within the branch meeting when I'm still kind of getting to know what the people in that organisation are about? And also, on the flip side, am I meant to be representing women in general within this organisation? And so, yeah, it's a real problem. I don't think I certainly can't speak for women, so I don't know what that's about. Sorry, it's not very coherent, but
thank you.
Okay, thank you. Would you like to continue?
Okay. I will try to answer Richard's question. We will certainly speak differently, or I certainly will speak differently, whether I address a trade union meeting or a works council meeting on my workplace or so. Then I wouldn't necessarily talk about class struggle, or if so, I would say, did you notice what they took away from us or will take away from us? You know, there is a struggle going on and it's coming from that side. Let's just call it what it is. It's the top against the bottom, and we can also call it class struggle. And I found that actually works quite well. But I think that this conference is one where one can also use the short forms. And I don't think that we normally would call them, just like in an article, we would normally use the short forms. But we might even say Obama, the President of the United States, assuming that everybody here knows it. I would speak about Hillary Clinton without telling exactly who she is. So that's a different issue. I know that I've been elected to a works council by saying that the company, the bosses will tell you that I'm a leftist. I can tell you that immediately myself, and I ran under a program that wasn't so easy to understand. And I, when somebody said that it's too complicated for me, I gave that to them in writing, and I put it on a black wall, and people asked what they hadn't understood. I think that it is actually easier than we think, and certainly most people who work have heard a little bit about Marx, even if they might not understand Marxism. But let's not forget that at the bank crisis or what, all kind of bourgeois newspapers suddenly came out with sayings like Marx is right, and people understood it, even though they might not never have read a word Marx said.
Okay.
I think that's
thank you.
Enough.
Yeah, there were a lot of questions for you.
A lot. I can only fall short on that, I guess. It's really so many really large topics. Let me try. So there has been the question of the task of modernity. Modernity is a really, really problematic project. There have been many like critical writings also on like the project of modernity as a colonialist project, and obviously like many like feminist writings that that have shown in that the way we understand gender as a binary concept today has actually also only evolved like as a bourgeois project in and of modernity. So yeah, it's not a very positive term, I guess, for anti-colonialist and feminist struggle. We're just kind of going there. Which also leads to the question of the totality, I feel, of struggles. I don't know where that question came from. Like the attempt, no, you were that, no? The attempt of trying to find a total approach. And everything I said earlier about intersectionality of positions or like of experiences, I don't know if anyone ever came across a text by one of my favorite socialist feminist writers, whose name is Donna Haraway, and she wrote a text that's called Situated Knowledge. And in this text, she develops the idea of trying to, through situated knowledge, like recognizing the situatedness of all knowledge, trying in like sharing these knowledges from all these different points of views to approach something that gets, like she says, we don't have to abolish the idea of objectivity at like in general, but we have to question the way, like she calls it the God's trick, like somebody would be out there, for sure somebody with a big beard, and knowing it all, like knowing all the experiences of everybody. Like maybe we should let go of the God's trick and try and reach approximate objectivity in gathering and communicating about all the different experiences. So I find that interesting. And the last thing is about the question of diversity in neoliberalism. I mean, like it's related for me to the question of quotas that I forgot to answer earlier too. If the old boys' networks give up their politics, then we can also like let go of the quotas, I guess. Like quotas is not a nice politics, but it's just necessary to like break through these old boys' networks. And diversity, the same, has limits. It has limits, and it has diversity politics. Is useful sometimes, but it can only, like anti-discrimination approaches can only go so far. And I think what they do is important, but they cannot obviously, they only go up to a certain point. And very last point, the success of feminism and the development of Marxism, I think like it is really crucial to understand that why does Marxism not seem like, why does it seem like a jargon or like not understandable to anybody else, although the other struggles like were more successful in trying to make their points to a more broader normal society, as many as that. I think that's also because they have evolved and they have exchanged with different parts of society, and I think it's really important. Like I feel, for example, I don't know if anybody of yours is familiar with the initiative of Care Revolution recently. So feminists have tried to like to contribute to a social critique, have tried to like to react to the crisis from a standpoint of reproduction and like, for example, building these networks. I just feel like at some point, like in French you would call this the mauvaise foi, I just don't understand why some, and it's not all, but
can
it's like...
Can you translate it into English?
Yeah, I can't, it's
bad
like...
Faith.
Yeah, that translates not so well, no? It's like bad intention or something, you know? It's bad faith. Okay, I'm sorry, my English is bad. In the sense of some Marxist groups just, as the comrade that now left said earlier, they just don't want to know about feminism, so you can't do anything about it. That's not a very nice aesthetic statement. Maybe, the whole thing about queer theory, that could be a speech of another hour. It is really interesting, and it's like it's a big discussion. For example, like also in the question of like evolving contexts of discussion and theory, the framework of like power as opposed to a framework of domination has certain advantages. For example, going back to the question of sexual revolution, feminists understood at some point you cannot liberate yourself through sexuality like this. Like sexual revolution has also been a failure for feminists, seeing that like you can't, that it didn't abolish sexism, and there can only be a sexual revolution if there's also a feminist revolution. You need to abolish gender oppression if you really want a real sexual revolution. And I think, Michel Foucault's work on thinking power has been extremely important for queer theory, but also for like queer theory inspired feminism. So there's so much more to say about it, but I'm taking all the time.
Okay, that's fine. Thank you.
So I just wanted to come back. I'm sorry, I probably made a bit of a leap, and maybe I didn't explain myself properly when I was talking about the colonism. And the SWP. What I was meaning is, what I tried to preface it with the fact is that sexism and racism and homophobia doesn't stop at the gates of an organization, and it will, you know, it will pervade or it will have some impact. But how do you combat that? And I think the economism of the SWP means that it can't within its own organization, so it didn't have any of the structures. So to be honest, it obviously it wouldn't have stopped the rape actually happening, but right away, or it might even have it if it had changed the culture within the organization, if women had the right to caucus. But if it happened, then right away, women would have been able to get together and discuss it and then, you know, actually present some solution or, you know, really bring it to the fore instead of having to wait, like, because I think the actual incident had happened like quite a few years before, and this woman suffered by herself. Right? There was no way within the organization that she felt that she could raise it and things. And I just think that's the thing, is that if you have you know, quite regular women's caucuses, these things come to the fore, come to light, come quickly, and then you can actually deal with it right away. And I think that in itself, you know, empowers women to organize together, but it also changes the culture within an organization as well, and it doesn't, you know, just perpetuate the same thing. I just wanted to really come back on two things. One is the idea that Marxism is a magic, or why do we need a magical theory of everything? For me, Marxism isn't a magical theory. It's a materialist analysis and an understanding how capitalism works. Within that, it sees the centrality of the fight between the two historic classes, the bourgeoisie and the working class, and who owns the means of production, and how, if you were going to transform society, how would you do that? And that would be to completely and utterly break that apart. And the other point I wanted to say is, like, the success of feminism, like, I'm not quite sure how successful it is, but it is in the sense that it's working within a system and it's, you know, it's fighting for these reforms. But the problem is, at the end of the day, that system of oppression still exists. And so to me, that is what we should be aiming for. That is what our target is actually to actually smash capitalism, smash the systems of oppression, and actually forge a whole new world. Like, that's my goal.
Okay. Thank you very much. Announcing the panel for tonight, so to let you know what you can visit next. So the next panel will be the panel on socialism, democracy, and social democracy in this room at 6:30. And you're all invited for the conference party, which is tonight at 9:00 in the bar Casablanca. Okay? We have food there. Obviously.
Hey, okay.